Hello again, and welcome to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love talking about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me as always will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. Today, we talk about Ridley Scott's dystopian science fiction masterwork, Blade Runner.
Yeah. Hey, Cesar, how's everything going with you?
Pretty good. I think it's been a bit of a busy week, but I've been looking forward to recording for quite a while now.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about this movie as well. You know, this is one of my favorites.
I think it's weird that, to be honest, we haven't talked about it already through the various iterations of this.
Well, for Celluloid Jelly, we've only done... This is our 13th episode.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, we've recorded, lost episodes before, though, too, yeah.
Lost episodes, yeah. I'll dig some of those up out of the archive later.
Yeah, really dusty.
You know, in that old iteration, which was the Setting the Frame podcast, we talked a lot about newer movies, though, didn't we? We spent a lot of time talking about what was in theaters.
Yeah, I think so. But we did occasionally do the older films too, though, right? I think so.
I honestly don't remember anything that we talked about. I mean, except for like
Man of Steel.
Did we have a lengthy Man of Steel conversation?
It may not have been the focus of that episode, but
I remember writing a full length Man of Steel review. I don't remember us talking about it a lot, though. But I'm sure you're probably right. I remember us talking about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
I guess that sounds about right.
Yeah.
2013, right?
Yeah. It was that summer we did a pretty good job of recording every few weeks. Whatever that summer was. Was that...
2013.
Jesus. Wow.
Pacific Rim.
One of your favorites that year.
That was a good summer.
Yeah. Summers have really not been great, though. Let's be honest. I mean, ever since they've been moving to, like, a longer blockbuster calendar, summertime seems to be very disappointing the last couple of years, I think.
I think so, too. I think I'm excited for films still, of course. But I think the movie season doesn't feel like one thing anymore.
Right. Absolutely. Summer used to be so jam-packed, it was almost like Christmas for 3 months at movie, for movie fans.
Yeah.
And the rest of the year, you know, then we were watching more serious fare and, less mainstream stuff. And now they're kind of like spreading that out, to the almost a 12-month calendar. I mean, January still is pretty much Oscar contenders and stuff like that. But starting in February every year, there's always a big, a big movie for Valentine's Day. So, I mean, we've had stuff like Kingsman and John Wick and Lego Batman and all kinds of stuff, in February recently. And this coming February is Black Panther, right?
Yes.
So that'll be Marvel's first, first attempt to really open up the calendar and make something that's... early in the year, a big hit. Because the earliest they've had a release has been April, right?
With Winter Soldier, right?
Yeah, I think so. Now, we had Logan this year in March, right?
Yes.
So that's a Fox Marvel movie, but Marvel Studios has not really worked the calendar outside of summertime and November. So.
Yes. Well, I guess, February is the natural place you want to keep a movie if they're going to start doing, three films a year now.
Yeah. So. Well, it also makes sense for Black Panther since February is Black History Month.
Okay. I guarantee you it was calculated.
Yeah. But yeah, in any case, so like now we have something to look forward to almost every month. That's a big film, which is cool. But, I'm an old guy, I don't like change, so I kind of miss the really jam-packed summer months.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, there's a certain kind of, maybe romanticism is kind of a strong word, but, you know, being able to spend the summer at the at a movie theater is, you know, is something, you know, I really look forward to, even if, let's say this year, attendance has definitely dropped at the theater.
Well, attendance is definitely a different conversation entirely and a very long one. So let's change gears, because I want to get your thoughts to see if you watched the new Star Wars The Last Jedi preview, which just premiered last week.
I definitely did not.
You did not? Oh. So we can't talk about it? That's disappointing.
Yeah, well, you know, if people want to discuss it, I see that there is a thread on the Cellular Jelly Facebook page. I'm going to do my utmost and not see anything else for this. It's pretty similar to how I took Blade Runner 2049. I only ever saw the first trailer for that movie all the way up until watching the film.
Wow. you're a shining example to us all when it comes to self-restraint there, Mr. Cesar. I don't know. When it comes to Star Wars, in Blade Runner and anything that I'm excited about, those trailers are too much to resist. So especially for Star Wars, I just couldn't not watch it. So
yeah.
Well, you know, Star Wars.
You'll get there someday.
No, probably not. Not. I don't mind though. See, like the way that movie marketing is half the time you watch a trailer and it's not a real representation of what you're getting as an experience in the movie anyway. So
sure.
I kind of feel like fans reacting to marketing materials like trailers and TV spots and things like that is almost sort of become like a side sport to the experience of watching a movie. And I kind of enjoy that aspect of it as well.
Sure. Yeah, it's like people watching, you know, I guess like for people who are like football fans, watching stuff at the combine before season starts or draft is even begun.
Sure. The combine. All right, well, the only other thing that I've seen this in the past week is Blade Runner 2049, and I think we should wait and talk about that at the end. So
yeah,
we
I
should
think so too.
We should probably just dive right in and talk about this. So, so today we're talking about the original Blade Runner. Well, original is probably not the right word. Ridley Scott's 1982 science fiction dystopian masterpiece about a cop who hunts down and retires android replicants manufactured by a company called the Tyrell Corporation. Six replicants return to Earth, try to break into the Tyrell Corporation. Two of them are killed and four of them escape. And the police turn to ex-Blade Runner Rick Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, to track down and eliminate them. Cesar, which version of Blade Runner did you watch? Because that's a whole discussion in and of itself.
Well, typically, the only version I watch regularly, if I want to watch Blade Runner, is Final Cut, which is the only version, which I guess first... For a lot of people, first saw the light of day in 2007 and is the only version of the film that had complete oversight by Ridley Scott. That's typically my preferred version and the version I watched for this recording today.
My preferred cut is the final cut as well. But I did watch the original 82 version and the work print also. So if you like the original cut and you like Deckard's narration, which I always found clunky, that's cool. There's certainly a much more classic detective fiction feel to it with the voiceover. And I know a lot of people prefer that. I remember in a recent interview, Guillermo del Toro said that that was his preferred version. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Denis Villeneuve, who directed Blade Runner 2049, said that he grew up watching the original version with the voiceover, and that that was his preferred version. So there's no wrong version to watch, but I agree with Cesar completely that the final cut is the best version of the film.
Yeah, I mean, like as long as you get to watch Blade Runner, I mean, mean, I think you really can't go wrong with any of them. Each one, now there's a lot of people who probably won't take the opportunity to watch every single version. And, you know, honestly, it is quite a bit of an undertaking. But it's, especially if you're a fan of any version you've seen before, to see the changes, the minute differences, and it's a pretty interesting kind of like progression of the Blade Runner film, especially going into the new film that we saw this year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you have the chance and you're a big enough fan of Blade Runner, or really even just a big enough fan of movie making in general, if you watch each version leading up to the final cut, you really do learn quite a bit about filmmaking and the choices that people have to make when they when they're making a movie. You know, and sometimes those choices are hard fought. And this, you know, in the case of like the narration for the original version, both Ridley Scott and Harrison Ford did not want to do it. Ultimately, Harrison Ford was locked in a room with a different producer, and Ridley Scott was not involved when he ultimately recorded the dialogue for that narration. So sometimes you have to do things for studios. And some, like the work print has temp music and a couple of alternate takes and a different opening to the film. Not drastically different, just the title sequence is different. So, you know, I definitely recommend, and one other thing I recommend is that I did personally was I listened to it without watching it the other night. I was intending to watch it, but I kind of put it on in the background and I started to do other things, and then I just kept doing other things. But I was picking up on some of the visual cues and some of the sound design things that I probably wouldn't have if I was watching the visuals more closely. So that was actually a really cool experience, I thought, for me. Mm-hmm. So where do you want to begin on this, big guy? There's so much you can talk about, honestly. You know, if you forget about the history of the production and you just look at the movie, God, go. Just go. Do it.
Well, Blade Runner is an incredibly complex film. There's a lot of themes. A lot of people know it's loosely based on Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But it deals with a lot of themes. I'm trying to think of what I can say, because 2049 also... kind of expounds on a lot of ideas that happen in this original film too. Philosophy, ideas of humanity. The movie has it's considered neo-noir. So there's a lot of similar themes to what we discussed, like when we were talking about Maltese Falcon in the past, which I want to say was, gosh, I don't remember which episode that was.
Even Le Cercle Rouge. This is definitely, out of the 13 episodes we've done quite a few that fall into the category of film noir, or are on the fringe of film noir, like The Hustler. I think the thing that drew me to Blade Runner initially, I did not see this in movie theaters in 1982. I did see it, I think, for the first time on television, probably in the late 80s, And I, you know, obviously Harrison Ford was a big draw for a kid like me who was a Star Wars crazy nerd, and an Indiana Jones fan. And I got to be honest, the first time I watched Blade Runner, you know, and probably because I was a young kid, it just didn't do anything for me. It moved a little slower than I was used to with Harrison Ford's other movies. You know, the visuals were, you know, eye popping. I kind of felt like the story dragged quite a bit. And even today, I kind of feel like, you know, I do consider Blade Runner a masterpiece within the genre of science fiction, but, I get why certain people don't like it. I really do. Like, You know, it starts off with a very dreamlike quality, and kind of in the middle of the film, it just becomes super vague. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that Harrison Ford's doing when they go to Leon's apartment. There's not a lot of explanation. We're just kind of observing what he's doing. If you're not paying attention closely and thinking about it, you know, you can kind of get a little bit lost with it.
You know, it's interesting how, like, some of the stuff that you've just described has become a lot of, like, the stuff that people love about this film.
Yeah.
It definitely is. Acquired taste isn't the right word, because it requires a more developed taste, I think.
Okay.
How old were you when you watched the film for the first time?
Early teens, probably.
Okay. First time I had seen it was probably in high school as well. So we're talking maybe 16 or 17 years ago. You know, it was with that very old kind of like bare bones DVD that Warner Brothers put out in their...
Sure, which was the director's cut, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I guess I was kind of with you there at the time. I mean, the visual stuff, you know, certainly my movie taste hadn't developed to the point where, like, I would have been able to discuss it. I think overall I liked it, but I wonder how much of that initially was because of, like, the reputation of the film for when I saw it at the time, kind of like tempering my opinion. I think the complexities and the things that people kind of cite as being reasons why they dislike the film, you know, pacing and things like that, have become the movie's strengths in recent years, especially considering how many people I've known that revisit the film, you know, a second, third, multiple times.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned that I was, you know, a huge Star Wars fan, a huge Indiana Jones fan. And the kinds of movies that I watched as a kid growing up, and the kinds of movies that I would rewatch constantly, were ones where typically plot was straightforward, point A to point B, you know, and Blade Runner is less of a plot-driven movie, really, than it is. I think that's secondary to ultimately what the real story is, and that's the love story between Deckard and Rachel. It, you know, it has all those beautiful visuals. It's got that amazing Vangelis score.
Well, I mean, like you mentioned Vangelis. Let's talk a little bit about the score. It's pretty atmospheric, and has become one of the things that people cite as one of the strong things. And from what I understand, it was always considered a very good score, even back when it first was released, before it had the cult status it's achieved since then.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for me, there's a real dreamlike quality to the score.
Absolutely.
It's sort of like it's symphonic in a way, but it's got like a synth bluesy vibe, the typical jazz soundtracks of many classic noirs. This kind of feels like a perfect update to something like that. Mm-hmm. I can identify a music cue from Blade Runner pretty much anywhere out of context, I think, because it's that distinctive.
How many times would you say you've seen any, you know, just together, the versions of Blade Runner?
Oh, I don't know.
A dozen times, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, three times this week with three different versions. But in the past, I mean, I've seen the final cut in theaters a few times since 2007. I've had the opportunity to see it a few times. To be honest, I think that was the first time I had ever seen it on the big screen, was back in 2007.
Yeah, me too.
So,
did we watch it together?
It was at the Senator.
No. I watched Final Cut.
It was at the Landmark downtown.
Yeah.
Yeah, then maybe we were together. Yeah, the Landmark in Baltimore City.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you got a keychain, right?
I never keep that stuff. That's so funny. Like, I used to keep all those, like, free movie giveaways, and I don't keep anything anymore.
See, well, I remember the keychain because that it was, for people who remember, I'm not sure if there will be many, but, like, the...
Was it the spinner?
It was a spinner car, yes.
Yeah.
Actually, my keychain for 3 or 4 years after that.
I think I remember that, actually, whenever you would twirl them around at Suncoast.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't on Lanyard, so, at the time.
But yeah, this movie's incredibly influential. There had been sort of dystopian science fiction movies before this. I mean, they were sort of big in the 70s, you know, stuff like Planet of the Apes and Soylent Green and, but this movie sort of had a visual look that has become incredibly influential, but it's sort of a mishmash. You know, you've got the dystopian aspects and the environmental, you know, like the ozone stuff and the constant rain, and there's never any daylight. It's all in darkness. So there's like a feeling of perpetual night,
yes,
in the film, which is very noirish. But you've got those environmental factors, you know, like that amazing Hades cityscape at the beginning, where the camera crawls towards the Tyrell Pyramid, and you've got the oil refineries are still blazing, you know, fire into the air, and smoke is everywhere, and it's haze, and it's a real, I mean, we didn't heed the warning, you know, but I mean, at the time, I think it was Ridley Scott and, you know, the writers, David Peoples and, Hampton Fancher, and Douglas Trumbull, who did the effects, and Sid Mead, who was their conceptual designer. He was credited as the futurist, but like all these guys coming together and saying, well, what will the future look like? And that, like, that's one of the biggest aspects of it, is that we're killing the planet. And part of the background of the story is that people who live on Earth are like the poor people. Like, all the rich people who could get off world are now off world.
It's only 2017. We still got 2 years to reach it.
Yeah.
Blade Runner can be a reality, everyone.
But that, I mean, that pessimism is something that certainly has stuck, and the visual look of Blade Runner has been, I don't know if adopted is the right word, but, you know, kind of stolen from and reused in countless commercials and music videos, and other movies have borrowed from it. And it's, you know, that's the future that we saw on movie screens up until the 1960s, early 70s, really got destroyed by movies in the 70s and 80s. And Blade Runner is the one that seems to have stuck more than most of the others. You know, the look of Star Wars and the look of something like a Soylent Green and things like that, kind of had like a worn down, almost documentary-esque kind of feeling to it. Whereas Blade Runner has such a highly stylized look at the future, that it really set it apart from what other filmmakers were doing at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the influences are, at this point, almost like innumerable to count, or the movies that have been influenced by it. I think, like, the tone and style pretty much defined, like, dystopian filmmaking.
Yeah.
Especially in terms of, like, modern filmmaking, with its kind of, like, lucky nihilism that was pretty prevalent in the 80s developing in filmmaking. So I think it kind of was lucky enough to kind of encapsulate a lot of those feelings, looking to the future, you know, in a film that's shot for the future.
Right. And it's amazing how the film was able to sort of predict the like integration of advertising into our daily lives and how that technology would begin to overtake the engineering and architecture of our cityscapes. And that's really happening. I mean, look at Hong Kong, look at Tokyo, look at Times Square in New York. You know, our modern metropolises are beginning to take shape in the form or style of the aesthetic of Blade Runner. You know, even billboards. I mean, I drive the I-15 in California here, Southern California, every day. And on the side of the road, the highways are being replaced by electronic, brightly colored billboards that look right out of Blade Runner. So, like, I mean, this film, it's like Star Trek. You know, I mean, scientists began to try to develop things that were thought of and put onto a fictional TV show, and now we're starting to see, the communicators in the 60s, no one ever thought that that would really happen, and now we have cell phones, computers in our pocket that, you know, essentially do what a Star Trek communicator did. And so Blade Runner is becoming a reality in terms of that predictable future.
We spent quite a bit of time talking about some, the art design, the visual look, the music. How about who are some of the people in Blade Runner?
Oh, it's a pretty great cast of actors and actresses who are not your typical A-list stars. Harrison Ford is the biggest star in the film. And while, I would say that Daryl Hannah and Sean Young have certainly been leads in other films throughout the 80s. People like Brian James, who plays Leon, and M. Emmett Walsh, who plays Bryant, and Edward James Olmos. These are character actors who are sort of really fleshing out the world. Everybody's pretty great in this, though. I'm a particular fan of Gaff, the Edward James Olmos character.
Yeah, he's excellent.
Well, I don't know if you want to get into anything else really specific, but the age old debate about whether or not Deckard is a replicant or not, do you want to take a stand on that?
Well, I think the question has been answered based on the second film, 2049. So, are you talking about the history?
Has it? Because I think 2049 sort of leaves it vague still. I don't think they really address that at all.
I guess in retrospect, you're right.
Thanks.
In this moment, I'm rethinking my life.
What, do you think it matters whether Deckard's a replicant?
No, I think if he is or if he is not, that certainly adds a complexity to his character. How am I going to describe this?
Don't you think that if he's a replicant, that the themes of Blade Runner sort of fall apart?
How so?
Well, ultimately Blade Runner is a story about a guy who represents humanity of his time, thinks of these androids as less than human. He's got that great line when he meets Rachel: replicants are like any other machine. They're either a benefit or a hazard. If they're a benefit, it's not my problem. As a Blade Runner, as a cop who has to hunt these guys down, it's natural for him to sort of rationalize his behavior and his job by saying that they're not human, that they're less than human. But I think the arc of the story is that by the end, he realizes that they are maybe alive in a way that he himself is not, that they understand the value of living more than he has himself in the past. And if he's a replicant himself and doesn't know it, I'm not so sure those themes have as much impact for me or resonate with me in the same way. Do you agree?
No. I think if you're like like the consideration that he's a replicant, and you know, prior to watching the new film, which I guess it, like I said, can be taken a couple different ways now. But I think if he's a replicant, I think that self-loathing is a pretty human trait. I think. I mean, you don't have animals typically, you know, being unhappy or depressed with themselves. I think, you know, his criticism of artificial humans can be taken, you know, like, I mean, he doesn't know, I believe he doesn't know that he's a replicant going into, you know, going into the film. That's definitely something that's just for us. And, you know, if he is, and they find out later on, yeah, I mean, that's something you table for when we talk about 49, I guess. But,
yeah, well, I just find it more powerful for him to question his own humanity as a result of his interaction with these replicants if he's human.
I think that's the whole point of the whole film, though. It's, you know, I mean, you're taking a look at what it means to be, like, a human. You know, there's ideals of philosophy and stuff that they definitely try to tackle, and, you know, the meaning of humanity. So if he's a replicant or a human, I mean, that's something that he explores with us as the audience.
And I certainly think Ridley Scott would agree with you. Questioning the reality of the world, Deckard's humanity, at the end of the film, perhaps deepens the experience upon multiple viewings, which, of course, the reputation of the film has been built upon over these years. For me, I think it cheapens the film a bit by making that revelation just like a twist or a stinger at the end that kind of goes unexplored by Deckard himself, because I don't think that he's questioning his reality before that. However, there is a strong case for the idea that Deckard is a replicant.
Yes.
So do you want to go over a couple of those real quick?
I mean, I guess the main scene that people talk about is the final, you know, with that's kind of expanded upon with Final Cut is, like, you know, Deckard has, of course, the unicorn dream,
which began in the director's cut and is carried through to the final cut, yeah,
expanded in the unicorn dream sequence. But you know, Gaff, of course, played by Ever James Olmos, he's an origami aficionado. Now he gives to Deckard a unicorn origami, which of course suggests that, like, his memories had been placed there, thereby suggesting he is a replicant, because he knows what Deckard dreams about.
Right, the same way that Deckard knows about Rachel's dream about the spider and the incident with her brother.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a big, you've also got, you know, the mirrored reflection in replicant's eyes, which you also see in Deckard's eyes when he stands behind Rachel in his apartment, and she says, "Would you come and find me if I go north?" And I'm paraphrasing here, but he says, like, "No, I owe you one." But he stands behind her and says, "But somebody would," and his eyes are glowing just like theirs are. There's also lines of dialogue, I think, like, Rachel says to him, "You know that Voight Kampff test of yours, did you ever take that test yourself?"
Yes.
Which certainly could indicate that she senses his own lack of empathy.
Also, you know, that scene happens, I mean, you know, her relationship with Deckard is, you know, she of course believes that she's human. So when, you know, when the test is administered, of course, she's kind of distraught, but she's still exhibiting human emotion, yeah?
Well, not during the test, but yeah, in that scene in Deckard's apartment when she says that line, she's definitely distraught. You're right about that. And they even do a nice subtle little thing cinematically by going handheld, which is something that they don't do very often in the film, but they go handheld in that moment to kind of, like, show how unstable her emotions are right there. Another great example of a piece of dialogue is Gaff's line in the film after Roy Batty dies, when he tosses the gun back to Deckard and says, "You've done a man's job. I guess you're through." which certainly you could look at as an old school type of thing, like man's job meaning you've done a heavy task, you know, congratulations. But to me, it seems a little bit more pointed. And when you combine that with the origami unicorn revelation at the end, it certainly seems like either Gaff heavily suspects or outright knows that Deckard is a replicant. So like by using that line, "You've done a man's job, sir," it's almost like he's sort of almost provoking Deckard in a way.
Well, you know, you don't see female Blade Runners either, though, in the film.
You don't see any other Blade Runners. We assume that Gaff is part of the Blade Runner unit, but who knows? The only other Blade Runner we see is Holden, and he gets shot in the beginning. We don't see any female cops. We don't see any women in a position of power anywhere. The closest thing is Rachel being Tyrell's assistant, or whatever you want to call that.
Yes.
So, although the women in the film, you know, if you look at somebody like Zora or somebody like Pris, you know, they certainly hold their own and can kick some ass.
Yes.
Now, on the other hand, audiences love to watch Harrison Ford get punched.
That's a secret to success.
It really is. Like, that's just like a trademark of like 80s Harrison Ford.
Yeah. Well, you know, most of those films, he's also not like, you know, a trained fighter. And, you know, it's always him against like pretty overwhelming odds.
Yeah, he's supposed to be a cop who can handle himself in this movie. And that's one of the things that I think is another point in the favor of Deckard being a replicant, is that the entire scene with Bryant doesn't make a whole lot of sense if Deckard is a seasoned Blade Runner. Like, they call him back in and they're like, "Dude, we need you, Deck. It's a bad one. This is the worst yet. We need your magic," I think he says to him at one point. And then he sits him down and basically explains like what these replicants are and what they, you know, what, you know, that they have 4-year lifespan and that there's combat models versus pleasure models and it just seems like
that's the exposition.
Yeah, it's obviously it's exposition for the audience, but they could have handled it in a different way. They could have handled it with Deckard explaining it to somebody else. Or they could have done it in voiceover back in 1982 if they were going to do voiceover. But like it feels like they're giving him an update of information that he should already have.
He's been gone.
Yeah, if he's been retiring replicants for quite a while, he would already know most of the stuff in that scene. And if you believe Deckard is a replicant, then it almost makes sense because they have to like bring him in and kind of bring him up to speed. Mm-hmm. Ridley Scott definitively had said that Deckard was a replicant in many interviews. Certainly the final cut leans heavily into that as well. I prefer to think of him as a human myself.
Okay. That's your prerogative.
That's right. Damn right it is.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So I guess we're going to be going at 2049 in different directions a little bit.
Maybe.
Yeah.
That's all right. That makes it more interesting. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Okay. I like disagreeing with you.
I like it too.
Well, what else can we talk about?
I think as I was rewatching the movie, I mean, there were things that they're not necessarily like fully formed, like motifs or, whatever. But like, I think it's interesting, like, that there are very similar phrases that Roy and Leon use when they're dealing with Deckard. Like, I don't know if you caught it. I'm sure you probably did. When Leon confronts Deckard, he asks him about incept dates and his birthday and how long he lives and stuff. And then once he decides he's going to kill Deckard, he starts to beat him up and he says, it's painful to live in fear, isn't it? And then later in that same scene, he's slapping him across the face, you know, incredibly hard because he can lift 400 pound loads all day. He's a brute. He says, wake up, time to die. And then later in the film, when Roy is having his moment with Deckard, he says, it's quite an experience to live in fear, isn't it? And then later, after we get the Tears and Rain speech, then he says, time to die. So, like, those seem like sort of almost like pre-programmed things in the replicants.
Well, also, you know, they're basically, replicants are also basically slaves, so there's bound to be similarities in terms of, like, speech patterns and, you know, vernacular, too.
Right, but that's a detail that would have been put there by the writers and by Ridley Scott that I think kind of, like, is subtle enough to where I really appreciate that idea.
Yes, I think, I mean, we haven't really talked about it, but Rutger Hauer gives a pretty, like, powerful performance. Probably his most iconic role, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Rutger Hauer never had a moment in his cinematic career, and he's had some other really, you know, good movies, but he's never had a moment like Blade Runner.
Yes.
That Tears and Rain speech will be something that people talk about forever, and it's, you know, reportedly that he came up with that himself.
Yes, that's what I heard as well.
Yeah, there's some conflicting reports, but even the writers credit him with it, so.
I mean, you know, I'd want to take credit for it if I made it.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, did John Woo get his dub thing from Blade Runner? Is that where that came from? Has he ever gone on record about that?
I mean, he's definitely been influenced by who knows how many films. To be honest, he didn't really see his use of dubs until probably like the mid 80s, and I'm not exactly sure how popular Blade Runner was in Hong Kong, like that early in his career.
Right.
Like you mentioned earlier, it didn't achieve the cult status that it had in the United States, that it has now, until, you know, a number of years later, by which point John Woo had already been using dubs. But I think, like, the dub metaphor, though, I'm sure he's not the first person to use it. Ridley Scott is. I'm sure dubs have been used in many other films in the past previous.
Yeah. Well, and John Woo went on to direct a Philip K. Dick adaptation himself.
Yeah, it was,
Sorry for laughing. It was Paycheck with Ben Affleck and Aaron Eckhart, right?
I was trying to remember what it was. I was like, is it Ben Affleck?
And it's really not that good. It's a fairly, I mean, you know, I like the concept, but the movie is not good.
Okay, so.
And Ben Affleck cannot run. Like, he runs very oddly.
Like, so, Steven Seagal?
Wow. Steven Seagal, like, he runs, like, where his, like, hands flap, right? Is that the deal?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like his elbows to his, like, shoulders are attached to his torso.
We've really gotten off track here.
But it's always interesting to insert a Steven Seagal reference.
Well, it's funny because I was watching a clip from the Jimmy Kimmel Show where he had Liam Neeson on to talk about his new movie. And He had Steven Seagal on prior to that. And then when Liam Neeson came on, Liam Neeson revealed that Steven Seagal had criticized him when the Taken movies came out and said that Liam Neeson didn't know how to punch a guy. And so Liam Neeson was on Jimmy Kimmel and he was like, I know how to punch a guy. He's like, I was a boxer. But he still had some kind words to say about Steven Seagal.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Well, he's a class act, that Liam Neeson.
Yeah, he has to be because, you know, Steven Seagal's a pretty funny, he's a guy that's pretty easy to, like, joke about these days.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think so.
I haven't seen a Steven Seagal movie for at least a decade.
Okay, well, I could really start talking about Steven Seagal, but I think we do need to get back on track.
We want to pivot back to Blade Runner.
Yeah, hard 180.
That's okay. That's how these things go, man. It's just about, it's just Stream of consciousness. Just go with it.
Yep. Avant-garde, if it anything. All right, I can't remember. Where were we at?
It doesn't matter. Well, do you want to, before we kind of transition into Blade Runner 2049, is there anything else you want to praise or talk about or, you know, about this movie?
You know, like, thinking about what we've just spoken about, I feel like we haven't really talked too much about Blade Runner at all. It feels like we haven't, but the movie has been kind of like dissected and discussed so many, many times. Both of us love this film. And, you know, it's kind of hard to add, you know, our two cents into something, into like this, a similar opinion that's held like the world over, and dissected by, you know, much more, educated film historians than, you know, than our amateur asses. But I mean, like, you know, Blade Runner, you know, it's a amazing film, and, you know, even if you need to force yourself to sit through it, I'm talking to you, Chelsea. It's absolutely worth your time. You know, watch it multiple times.
No one knows that reference, so I'll just say that that we were going to have a third person on this podcast originally, and that person fell asleep watching Blade Runner at least twice, and so now she's not on it. Yes, because she's never seen the ending.
Now you're a joke.
Oh. All right, that's
all right. Well, surprise.
Well, one last thing, I guess, before I have one last thing before we move on to Blade Runner 2049. I agree with you that we are both amateur asses, but like you, I love this movie. This is one of my favorite movies, even though, you know, I do find a lot of flaws and continuity errors. Yeah, where does Rutger Hauer get that dove? There's never a scene of him picking up a dove in the movie, right? He just shows up with it on the rooftop.
Maybe, you never know.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, Deckard runs through when he kicks out the window to get on the building at the end of the film, when he's running away from Roy Batty. He goes through a room and he disturbs like a nest of pigeons, doves, whatever they are. And he gets out there and Roy follows him and doesn't have the bird. And then Deckard climbs up. We follow Deckard up to the rooftop. And then when Roy shows up, he just has a dove in his hand. So it's just like, okay.
Well, he let the doves fly up too. And then he caught it while he was up there. Or a cutaway scene.
I don't know. It's just one moment he has nothing, and the next moment he has a dove. It's just, you know.
Listen, man, it's poetic. Just let it be.
I mean, the movie's poetic. I agree with you. But, like, you know, still, like, there's just little things, you know.
You're right. Blade Runner's horrible.
It's not horrible. It does drag a little bit in the middle, and it's, as a detective story, there's not a whole lot of detective work going on.
A lot of wandering around and getting lucky.
Well, there's about, God, I don't know, and I'm just guessing, but there's probably about 15 minutes of the movie that features detective work. And most of that was added in after they hired Harrison Ford. You know, one of the script notes that he gave was that the things that they were going to do in voiceover, he wanted to actually see them on the screen. So they had to add a couple of scenes of Deckard actually doing something. So like the scene in Leon's apartment and, him examining the photographs and stuff like that are really, that's the extent of like him doing any kind of police work, and then following the clues with the scale. So he takes the scale to the artificial fish woman and she tells him to go to the Egyptian, and then he goes from the Egyptian to Taffy Lewis's place, and that's where the police work ends. Like, yes. That's it. So as a procedural, it fails miserably, but that's not the point of the film. So, you know, we can forgive that. Yeah. I feel like there's so much we haven't covered, such as Ridley Scott's obsession with eyes, sight, or vision, or the obvious Frankenstein comparisons, but we kind of have to move on. So, what did you think of Blade Runner 2049?
Okay, we're just going to jump right into it?
Yeah, I mean...
well, I guess...
go for it.
I saw it about, I guess, a week ago today. So
it does feel like I saw it a long time ago. It really, yeah. Like, when did it come out?
Last Thursday.
So it hasn't even been a week for me, and it feels like it was 3 weeks ago.
Well, you did watch Blade Runner 3 times.
Work's been really kicking my ass, so that's...
Sure. Blade Runner 2049... it's kind of hard for me to kind of place it. Overall, I really, really enjoyed the film.
Absolutely. Really good.
I think that, like, it's hard for me to kind of, only a week out to have final thoughts on it. I have to let it kind of percolate, quite a bit more, but you know, gut reaction, you know, it's a good film, like a damn good film, possibly, the best film I've seen in a theater this year so far.
I would say it's definitely up there. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time, you know, going through my favorites from the year, but Blade Runner is probably in the top five right now, I think.
Yeah. I think that Denis Villeneuve, he's possibly the best director working in Hollywood right now. Like, I think he's not a director that's ever steered me wrong with one of the films that he's directed. I haven't seen all of his films. I think the only one I'm missing is the... I want to say it's his debut film.
Incendies?
No. It's the one about the Montreal massacre. But I the title escapes me right now. But like...
Did he not direct Incendies?
He did.
Okay. All right, that one I have not seen either.
Yeah, that was not his debut film, though. But yeah, I think he's a director that has a vision, and somehow when you watch his films, it's kind of like exactly what he wants. He can elicit the exact response in you as an audience member, and you know, but also bring complex ideas to his films that have you thinking about his work, you know, way after like you've left the theater.
Absolutely. And for anyone who hasn't seen Arrival, that was the movie he did before Blade Runner with Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner, another science fiction picture. And I quite enjoyed that. I definitely recommend that one too. Prisoners was really good.
Yeah, Prisoners. I think Prisoners is probably his best film.
Were you referring to Polytechnique?
I guess so.
Okay.
So, he did direct that though, yeah?
Yeah. Actually, that's not his first movie. He did a feature called Maelstrom in 2000.
Okay, well, the two films of his I haven't seen yet.
But yes, you're absolutely right, and we're, you know, Sicario, Arrival, Blade Runner, Enemy, Prisoners.
The amount of, like, filmography he's accrued just in the last, like, 5 to 10 years. Like, it's really impressive, like, body of work.
Yeah, and he, and in collaboration with Roger Deakins, who we can certainly talk about for days as well, you know, one of the top three working cinematographers, period. They come in and they take a little bit of a different approach to Blade Runner 2049, but it still feels of the same world as Blade Runner. It is 30 years later, but I read a snippet in an interview that Denis did, and he said the first Blade Runner was through the lens of a kid who grew up in England, so it rained all the time, and he grew up in Canada, so it snows all the time in his movie. So those are like the big major differences, I guess. But the color palette, and especially like in the Las Vegas scenes, is very striking. The stuff that happens in downtown LA still feels like the original Blade Runner, even though it has sort of a more digital feeling than Scott's movie. What Scott was able to accomplish with Blade Runner was pretty amazing. And if you ever have the chance, you should watch the Dangerous Days documentary.
Yeah, I've seen it once, probably it wasn't right when Final Cut was released. Like I purchased the set, but I probably didn't watch it until 2009 or 2010 though.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times
it's long.
it is very long. Yeah. A lot of times filmmakers who have vision and are very driven, to capture that vision on film as close to their original vision as they can are often labeled as difficult to work with, madmen, you know, what have you. Coppola on Apocalypse Now comes to mind, and watch Hearts of Darkness, the documentary about that. But Dangerous Days really sort of depicts the shoot of Blade Runner as being tremendously difficult, hard for everybody, tons of night shoots, and Ridley Scott just being very uncompromising.
What was the line in the trailer? There's a line in the trailer for Dangerous Days, like the preview for it,
where Harrison Ford says it was a bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good documentary. It's certainly an investment of your time, but it's broken up into chapters, so you could always watch it in multiple viewings.
Yeah, I watched it in probably two or three sittings.
Yeah. Getting back to 2049, though, I think, you know, we talked earlier about, they don't really address the issue of whether Deckard is a replicant or not. But I would still say if you haven't seen Blade Runner, you should watch it before watching Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I wonder how many people went to watch this film last week but had never seen the original Blade Runner.
My guess would be quite a few, actually.
Yeah.
Although, couldn't have been too many. Like, it underperformed at the box office. Although, I'm not sure a $32 million opening in October is underperforming for anything.
I thought it was projected for $100 million. I thought that was pretty lofty.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, they spent, I think the budget was somewhere around $150 million on this movie. Mm-hmm. I personally, knowing what a failure Blade Runner was initially, before it attained its cult status on VHS and through TV screenings and through the underground film movement with that work print. I don't know if I would have spent $150 million making this movie.
Sure.
Regardless of Ryan Gosling and, you know, the mainstream popularity that has come to the film since then. That was still a big gamble on their part, and hopefully it'll pay off with international box office and with, you know, home video and streaming money and stuff like that. Because I'm sure they're not going to get a ton of merchandising money out of it, but the reviews have been very kind to it, and I hope the second and third weekends don't drop off too much and it's able to sort of, you know, stay in theaters for a while.
Yeah, I saw it once, but it's definitely a film I expect to catch at least a second time at the theater.
Yeah. It's long.
You know, it really doesn't feel that long, though.
Well, I didn't think it felt overly long, but it definitely is long. I mean, yeah, with credits, it's 2 hours and 43 or 44 minutes, something like that. Yeah. So your experience at the movie theater is over 3 hours, thanks to the 15 to 20 minutes of previews that you get.
While we're talking about it, let me do like the quick plug for The Senator. The screen that we went to for 2049 had no trailers in front of it. Jumped right into the picture.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
Well, there you go. If you guys are in the Baltimore area, go see it at the historic Senator Theater, Baltimore's premier show place.
Why would you go anywhere else, guys? For real. I
got to tell you, and we're getting off topic again, but that's okay. And moving out here to California and being close enough that I've been to LA a few times now, the Senator is still my favorite movie theater. I saw a beautiful 70mm print of Dunkirk over the summer at a what we consider a true IMAX theater. I saw a double feature just last weekend of Baby Driver and The Driver, Walter Hill's The Driver. And both Walter Hill and Edgar Wright were there, and it was at the Egyptian Theater in LA. And real nice theater. I enjoyed it, but it just doesn't have the same feeling walking into it that walking into the Senator.
Sure. Like you mentioned Dunkirk. I saw that this summer at the AFI for 70 minutes.
Oh, in Silver Spring?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that theater too.
Yeah, it's a great theater.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's something about, like, having such a great historic theater that's, like, for me, still, like, close by. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not the closest theater, but it's, to me, but it's well worth, like, the trip. And it's one of the few theaters where I consistently buy concessions at. I do anything I can to, like
absolutely.
Try to plug it a bit.
That's funny because I just had that conversation with somebody the other day. Like, I don't buy concessions typically, and one, because I don't eat a lot of junk food anymore and I don't drink soda. But at the Senator, I would always get a root beer and some peanut chews.
Yeah.
Just because I wanted to support them. I wanted to give them money. They're an independent theater. They're not owned by a corporation. It's not AMC. It's not Regal. They haven't been taken over by somebody else, who is going to make decisions that are based on anything other than that one location. And that's part of the charm of it, is that, it's run by local people who love Baltimore. It's run by movie fans. And like you said, they're smart enough not to put a ton of previews on a movie like Blade Runner 2049 that's already almost 3 hours long. I mean, that might have been something they did to squeeze one extra show in that day, but it feels more like them just saying, hey, look, you come out to our theater, we appreciate it, we're not going to bog you down with a bunch of advertisements.
Yeah, I mean, I think they know their audience, and, thankfully, the theater was pretty packed. It wasn't, I don't believe it was sold out, but there was a sizable crowd present to watch, like, the first screening of the film.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, real quick, let's pivot back to Blade Runner 2049. I know, we both said that we highly enjoyed it. Is there anything else that you want to point out or talk about, before we kind of sign off?
I guess, obviously we're talking spoilers. The film itself, I think it does a really good job of kind of twisting you around a bit.
Yeah, I didn't want to talk any, like, major spoilers, but yes, absolutely. Like, they set you up for one thing and don't necessarily pay that one thing off in the way that you expect to.
Yes, absolutely.
So I love that about that film, because the one thing that I talked to, I saw it with Chelsea and afterwards, I was like, thank God blank didn't happen, because I felt like they had really kind of, like, set it up too much. And then it turned out to be something different, and they twisted it in a way that I really enjoyed.
Well, I think also Blade Runner has, like, a unique quality to it. Like, I mean, it's only two films, but I guess as a franchise, you immediately try to search for meaning in every little thing.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing this movie a second time, and I will see it a second time in the theater. The first time I just kind of let it wash over me, just in initial reactions. I like it. I don't like it. I like these shots. I like this piece of music. I like this performance. I don't really dig that deep into it on the first viewing. And I'm looking forward to kind of, like, really, like, examining it a little bit more. And I think, you know, like you said earlier, with a filmmaker like Villeneuve, like those, that minutia is there if you want it and you want to, you know, dig into it and analyze it, there's plenty there to do to analyze and unpack.
Yes, absolutely.
Ryan Gosling's pretty good in it. I know not everybody's a big Ryan Gosling fan. You know, he's certainly been prepping for this movie for quite a long time. And if you watch his character in Drive or in Only God Forgives, you know, he's certainly well practiced in being sort of robotic, stoic, you know. He was perfect for this particular role, I thought. I thought Robin Wright was pretty good in this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for those of you who don't watch House of Cards and don't remember how damn good Robin Wright can be, you should watch House of Cards. But you know, she's very good in her brief scenes in this movie, I thought. I particularly like the scene where she goes to his apartment, and I don't want to reveal what happens in that scene. You know, cause I want to give people a chance to see it. But I thought, I think that was my favorite scene with her in it.
Yeah. It's a great scene. I think, it's a really great, I want to say like that scene, it's probably about 10 minutes or so. Like, you know, she bookends, two bits of it, but
yeah,
I like, her name is Ana de Armas. I thought she was pretty good in it. They took her character and I think add another layer, which I totally did not expect. I mean, I know I went to the film, you know, as blind to, you know, previews and stuff as I could.
Right.
The character that she portrays definitely is another interesting addition, which kind of like moves, you know, the idea of replicates and humanity and AI going forward, you know, a natural progression, you know.
Absolutely. It's interesting that, like, in 1982, our vision of where computers would take us was androids. And they've had to sort of meld that idea into the new Blade Runner, and they do that with her character. And I think you're absolutely right. It adds a layer that provides complexity for technology in that world in general, and specifically for his character.
Yes.
Dave Bautista's pretty good in his, I guess it's one scene, really, right?
Yeah.
You know, so he's in the very early part of the film, but he's a very important part of the film, and he's very good.
I think the reveal with him, the scene that they use him in at the very beginning is a good reveal for Ryan Gosling's character.
Yeah, absolutely. They actually
taking a stand right off the bat.
They took that was a scene that they wrote for the original Blade Runner, or it's like a scene they wrote for the original Blade Runner that they sort of recycled for this movie, and I'm glad they did, because if you watch Dangerous Days, they kind of go through like you know, things that were cut and scenes that they had spitballed and didn't use. And that was one of them, where Deckard would have visited a replicant at the beginning of that film before the main Roy Batty story started. And they sort of repurposed that for this Dave Bautista character. And I think it's easy to dismiss the scene as just a cool opening. But as you get further into the movie, you'll realize how important that scene is.
Absolutely. I think Dave Bautista, he's definitely one of those professional wrestlers who has charisma outside of the ring, too.
Yeah, he's terrific in Guardians of the Galaxy as Drax. And, it, you know, big guys who have great sense of humor, for whatever reason, I get tickled and delighted by like people like him and The Rock, and you know, when they can play comedy just as well as they can play action. And for anyone who watches a lot of movies, that scene in the original Guardians of the Galaxy where where it's, I can't remember, somebody says that it went over his head, and he says, "Nothing goes over my head. My reflexes are too fast. I will catch it." Yeah. That scene in particular sort of has endeared Dave Bautista to me forever, I think.
Yes. I think he's definitely a guy to look out for. I mean, who knows? I mean, Dwayne Johnson, he's definitely reached, like, the stratosphere when it comes to, you know, I guess Hollywood film.
Yeah.
For a professional wrestler.
Getting his own spinoff for Fast and the Furious.
Absolutely. It's crazy, like, where he's gone.
He's in the new Jumanji movie, and he's also headlining a new Disney Jungle Cruise movie. So he's, yeah. I mean, there's nothing bigger than The Rock right now. He is. Yeah.
It's the biggest movie, probably the highest earning movie star in the world.
Yeah, it's too bad that that didn't happen a decade ago instead of now. But, you know, I mean, he'll be all right, I think. I think he'll be able to retire comfortably at some point.
Yeah. Rest, you know, he seems like he's got like two or three movies a year.
Yeah. Also in Blade Runner 2049 is Sylvia Hoax. I think I'm saying that right. And she plays a character called Love, which is spelled L-U-V, which is a nice nod to THX-1138. So the love interest to Robert Duvall's character, THX, in that movie is L-U-V. And she's sort of like a female Terminator. She's a replicant who works for Jared Leto's character, who essentially is the antagonist of the film.
She's hunting.
Yeah, she's on the hunt, and Ryan Gosling has to figure out what's happening before he comes into conflict with this particular character. So. And then, of course, there's Jared Leto. What'd you think of Jared Leto?
You know, like, I think Jared Leto is a pretty good actor. He brings an intensity to his role, but I think he can kind of overstay his welcome in a lot of films. I think the amount that they use him in the film, I thought, was a good amount. They don't, I'm trying to think of how to describe this without spoiling anything. His storyline is not done by the end of the film. Not sure. That I think that there's going to be a sequel or that a sequel is necessary. But.
Well, if they don't make any money, there's definitely not going to be a sequel. But yeah. They certainly could explore more stories in this with video games or comics or a movie if it ends up, you know, doing well overseas.
But, you know, overall, I mean, I think he's fine. I certainly don't have the criticisms of him that seem to be kind of prevalent in a lot of other circles that have been discussing this film and his work.
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps he takes himself too seriously, but so many other actors have done that in the past as well. And there's a line, you know, I guess that you don't cross, which maybe he did, you know, during the production of Suicide Squad. There were reports of him sending like really weird things that were freaking out the other cast members. But you know, I think, you know, the difference between, you know, what somebody like Daniel Day-Lewis does, you know, where he stays in character on set the entire time and doesn't break, you know, I mean, he's not the only guy that can do that. You know, it's okay to me. It's okay for me if Jared Leto does it too. I mean, yeah. I'm not putting him on the same level as Daniel Day-Lewis, of course, because Day-Lewis is the man. But Jared Leto, like you said, he's a fine actor. I like that you said that he has an intensity. I think that's a perfect way to describe it. I've liked him in many things. I think his small character in Fight Club is really good. He's also in two David Fincher movies. He's also in Panic Room. And I thought he was great in Dallas Buyers Club.
Yes. Excellent.
Yeah. And I think he's good in this. And I didn't mind his Joker. You know, I'm on kind of in the middle. Like, if they continue with him as the Joker, I'm okay with it. If they don't, I'm okay with it. You know, I think his Joker was fine. It was okay.
Yeah, okay. Okay is the word.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. I don't think there was much special about it. But, you know, it wasn't his movie. It was a movie about the squad.
There's a lot of people who have an idea of what they think Joker should be. And, like, any deviation from it is seen as an affront.
Well, at this point, though, you've had so many different people tackle the Joker through, through visual medium as well as comic book and through cartoon series. And like, could anyone ever say that there's only one like way to do the Joker now? Like, I think it's wide open.
No, but like moviegoers, especially moviegoers who read comic books, are not necessarily known as the most like logical bunch.
Well, you interact with those people on a daily basis, sir.
Sure. I think at the same time, I mean, there's two levels of it. You have to be able to reconcile like your interpretation and what your desire is for a film versus what's like a truthful version from jumping medium from page to screen. You know, it's there's just a lot of people who just don't understand that there has to be differences. It's just, you know, I think the only like real thing that I think that can really be a subject of criticism, like especially in terms of previews, would be like the costumes, like in terms of superhero films anyway, not just all comic book adaptations. So I think, the look of a character goes a long way. That's half of the medium in terms of comic books. So as, you know, if a film could get that right, you know, typically it bodes well. There's a tendency where they make the look of the character incorrect, and that makes the film suffer too, because it underscores a misunderstanding right off the bat of what a character is. A character isn't their costume, but if they can't get that right, that's a bad sign generally.
I always felt like costume was less important.
Yeah, you think so?
I mean, you want it to represent the core idea, I guess, but like, yeah, sure. I mean,
I know what you mean.
Talking specifically about like comic book medium, you know, like I remember like the big hullabaloo when they unveiled the first picture of like Brandon Routh as Superman in Superman Returns, because
I think he looks fine as Superman though.
But the costume was darker and more maroon than red, and they'd sort of toned that down and taken some of the brightness away from it. And I remember a lot of people were really upset about that, and I was like, "Eh, whatever, I don't care, as long as he's Superman."
Recognizable as Superman, though, you know. And you know, I guess they took that criticism to heart with Man of Steel, where they turn everything like a notch darker too.
Yeah. That whole movie's like brown and blue. Like you usually get like that that orange teal thing going, which is funny because like Blade Runner 2049 has like an orange teal thing going on. But like in Man of Steel, like everything's sort of like brown.
Just like Superman. Brown. When I think of Superman, I always think of brown.
We'll see how they use him in Justice League. You know, it's funny, Justice League's only like a little over a month away.
Yeah, it's, you know,
Thor's less than a month away.
3 weeks away.
I know, it's crazy. I gotta get going on my Halloween like stuff.
Oh yeah, I'm a little bit behind too. I've only watched like six or so.
I'm so far behind this year. And you know, like there was a point, as you know, where I had moved across the country and I wasn't working for a couple of months. And during that time, I was able to watch a bunch of TV and movies. But like before moving and after getting my new job, like sometimes I'm not getting home till well past midnight. And a lot of times I just don't have after I eat and settle down and say hello to everybody and relax, I just don't have time for a movie a lot of nights. So it's been tough. It's been really tough to keep up, and I haven't been to the theater as much. So I'm going to make it a point to try to, you know, squeeze in, you know, at least 10 horror films between now and the end of the month, to, you know, get myself back on track. And I know we have decided to do one of your favorite horror movies for our next episode, which is A Tale of Two Sisters. Wait, say that again?
It's my favorite horror film of all time.
Wow. I can't wait to revisit it. So yeah, I'll watch that over the weekend, and we can talk about it next week.
It's a film I watch every October. So
Well, then you're going to take the lead on that. I'm going to let you do all the talking.
Okay. So. Man, I can do it.
That's fine. I'll be the color commentator for that particular episode. You can just throw it to me whenever you need to grab a drink, and I'll say something, and you can go back to it.
I'm looking forward to your pronunciations of actors' names.
Oh, man. I'm going to get it right. I'm going to work on that over the weekend to make sure that I'm okay on it.
That's me. Yeah, I mean, I don't think you need to say that. You should have just done it.
Fine. Maybe I'll cut that out then.
Okay. It's up to you, man. You're the one, you know, this will be your Blade Runner final cut.
It'll be the celluloid jelly cut.
Yep.
CJ cut.
Caesar Jr. cut.
Yeah. That's why we did that.
Yeah. In case you all didn't know.
That's going to be the new intro is celluloid jelly because Cinema Jam was already trademarked.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Don't you remember that? That whole debacle. Like, I even created a Cinema Jam logo, and it was already trademarked.
Okay. I don't remember that at all.
So instead we got celluloid jelly, but I like it.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, it's grown on me. Yeah. All right, well, let's wrap this shit up.
Okay. Game over.
It's been a pleasurable 90 minutes, but I'm going to...
It's only been 90 minutes?
It has been.
Wow. Okay.
So I think we should wrap it up, and I'll prepare for A Tale of Two Sisters for next week.
I think I'll pull my DVD off the shelf right now and just set it by the player. But yeah, we'll be recording that soon, guys.
So, but for the rest of you guys, let us know about your thoughts on both Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. Cesar, where can people find you online?
You can visit filmsmash.com, Asian film news and reviews. You can also find me on Twitter at Junior Biho.
Anything up on Film Smash that you want to pimp out right now?
Well, nothing up recently. I am about to put up a review for a recent Ju-on film, which people know as The Grudge. Not the most recent one, but the one previous to that. So a fairly recent one, though.
As part of like your October horror push?
Yeah, I'm not specifically doing an event this month for horror films in October, but I definitely want to get at least one horror film review up before the end of the month.
Have you done a print review for A Tale of Two Sisters?
I don't think so, actually, no.
Yeah, you should do that, too, definitely.
Okay, it'll be a nice companion piece.
If it's your favorite horror movie of all time, man, definitely share that passion. Share your words.
It is excellent. But also, I've been watching, for October, I've been watching a lot of really horrible, like, cheapy Japanese horror films, so.
Yeah.
Those are a lot easier to write reviews for.
Well, send me the links to any horror movies you've reviewed, and I can put them in the show notes.
Okay, cool.
Cool. Anyway,
where can people find you, CJ?
They can find me right here on Celluloid Jelly, and they can find me on Twitter at Setting the Frame.
Awesome.
So you all have a good week. Go see some movies. Let us know what you're seeing. Keep posting the Celluloid Jelly forum. And we'll catch you next time.
Yep. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Cesar.
Thanks, CJ.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to celluloid jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.